Before we jump into a great episode, a quick note on the next event in Talking San Diego coming very soon. It will be May 15th at 7 p.m. at University of San Diego's Shiley Theater. I'll be talking with former White House press secretary, current MSNBC host, and new author, Jen Psaki. Watch for Jen talking about her book on all the major shows, from today to late night and in between, starting this week. Tickets for our event are going very quickly, and there aren't that many left. So if you're in the general vicinity of San Diego, or have friends who are, you can purchase tickets or get more information, plus an opportunity to get a signed copy of Jen's new book by clicking the link in the episode description. Hope you can make it. Welcome to Talking Feds, a roundtable that brings together prominent former federal officials and special guests for a dynamic discussion of the most important political and legal topics of the day. I'm Harry Littman. New York versus Trump marked its 10th day of trial with the appearance of Hope Hicks, who, stressed to the point of tears, corroborated key parts of the DA's case, including the huge panic in Trump land when the Access Hollywood tape was published, and Trump's knowledge of the payoff to Stormy Daniels. The mayhem on campuses with demonstrations and occupations related to the war in Gaza continued to spike, and several administrations took action to break up entrenched encampments of demonstrators. In campaign news, Trump gave a remarkably dark, near apocalyptic interview setting out his autocratic plans if he wins in November, while Biden displayed a more limber and funny side of himself in campaign events. To analyze the hand-to-hand combat taking place on campus, in court, and in Congress, and assess the prospects for civil resolution of our most bitter current national battles, we welcome three of the country's most wise and respected voices. And they are Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren. She served in the House since 1995 and represents California's 18th district. As everyone knows, she served on the January 6th committee and played a prominent role in the committee's public hearings. Thank you very much, Congresswoman, for returning to Talking Feds.
Of course.
Norm Ornstein, maybe a charter Talking Fed stalwart and an emeritus scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a contributing editor for The Atlantic, a best-selling author, and the co-host of the podcast Words Matter with Dr. Kavita Patel. Welcome as always, Norm.
It's a particular honor to be with you and these guests today.
And Michael Steele, a political analyst for MSNBC and host of the Michael Steele podcast. He served as chair of the Republican National Committee from 2009 to 2011. Thank you very much, Michael Steele, for joining us.
Great to be with you. I'm excited. I mean, you got a congresswoman, you got a notable thinker, and me. So I'm happy to be in the room. And also want to note that I got a new gig at MSNBC, got my own show, The Weekend.
Excellent.
Which we need to get you guys on every Saturday, Sunday from 8 to 10 a.m. on MSNBC. I've got Alicia Menendez as a co-host and Simone Sanders Townsend. So, you know, they keep me in line. So
no kidding. That's great. For the congresswoman and me, it'll be a little tricky, that 8 a.m. East Coast start, but we'll make it sometime. All right, the Trump trial. Let's begin there. You know, having been there, I'll give a quick report. I don't think we need to go through the nitty-gritty of what's been happening. I'd say that the DA has told an effective story from Dino the doorman and culminating in Stormy Daniels, and she's now front and center. That leaves little doubt that when she came forward shortly after the Access Hollywood tape had gone public, the campaign was on life support, and there was a real possibility that her story could have pulled the plug. So there are still hurdles to get over, especially with the actual 34 counts of falsifying records and tying them to Trump. But as a former prosecutor, I'll just say so far, so good. So we can talk more about the legal nitty-gritty if any of you likes, but I thought we could broaden the lens a bit. Let's start here. How do you think the trial is playing in the country as a whole?
I think actually overall, I don't think people are paying that much attention. The people who are very negative about Trump are paying some attention. I think the people who are cultists towards Trump are paying attention, but I think most people are busy with their lives and not hanging on every word. I'm not getting any input in my calls or letters or emails from my constituents, not many.
I'd agree with that. I mean, I think this is one of those things where you wind up, quite honestly, folks largely tuned out until the jury renders a verdict, and then everybody tunes in and tries to play catch up about what the trial was about and how did they come to the verdict they came to. And politically, that's the moment where you try to contextualize the last 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks of the case and condense it to, you know, explain the result and to sort of get in front of, if Trump is convicted, what that narrative looks like. If Trump is acquitted, what that narrative looks like from both the Democrat-Republican side, but even from the judiciary side. I mean, the court is going to have to be prepared in some form or fashion to clarify or to be clear about what this verdict means. And that's how our process is. Those of us on the periphery don't pay attention. Those of us in the room do. And then there's that moment where a decision is rendered, where everybody thinks they know everything about the case, starts flapping their lips.
So let me make a couple of larger points. One is a cautionary note that I think Zoe raised that's important. It's for most of the things that we focus on, the vast majority of Americans don't. They live their lives. They get up in the morning, they go to work, they have to deal with their kids, with their mortgage payments or rents and all the rest of it. And we have to be careful about overemphasizing important things that happen that just are not there, not even scratching the surface for most people, until, as Michael said, a very big event. I've actually been thinking about this week because of something else, which is Eric Cortolesa's interviews with Trump that are in Time magazine. Most wannabe dictators don't telegraph what they're going to do. They try and downplay it until they're there, and then they do all of their horrible things. Trump is telling us flat out what he's going to do. He would lead us into a vicious, sadistic, autocratic state, but most Americans don't know that either. When it comes to the trial, for the Trump people, for 40% of Americans, I think the reality is he could take an AR-15 on Fifth Avenue in broad daylight and mow everybody down, and they would say, never mind, he's still the guy we want. For 10%, which is the swing voters, the college-educated suburban voters in the 7 or 8 states that matter, that's where the verdict, I think, is going to be resonant, if it is a verdict, and certainly the prosecution has laid out a powerful case that finds him guilty. And I actually think even if it's 11-1, if he ends up getting out of this because there's one juror who's a part of that group that would let Trump do anything, I think it's still going to be a very powerful case that this guy is a criminal. And if it's the only trial, and it may be, that'll be very important.
That'll be a very interesting bellwether, because certainly he'll declare victory if it is a mistrial. I saw some comments at a Trump rally, and it was more than just not paying attention, but an almost sort of contempt. I don't think people were accusing the trial of being a political show trial, but they just were seeing it as really small potatoes that had been torqued up. But the trial has told this story very compellingly, that as of that moment, there was a huge crisis just in the revelation of Trump's misconduct. Have we changed so much since 2016 that what seemed to have a seismic effect, the sexual misconduct and the cover-up, is a big nothing burger? It's like part of your AR-15 point, Norm?
I fear that. But I do think, you know, it's just, I can frame the election ahead very simply, and it is an existential one. But we're looking at a presidential level at 7 or maybe 8 states. We're looking at 2 groups of people, the Democratic Party's base, which has to get energized, and that's a real problem right now for Joe Biden, and those college-educated suburban voters, Republicans, some independents who don't much like Biden and really don't like Trump. And stuff like this, if there's a conviction, can make a difference. And we have to make a case. There has to be a case made that a vote for anybody else is a vote for Donald Trump. For some of them, they'd rather not vote for either of them. But that's where this trial and potentially another trial ahead, I think, can make a difference. The idea, even if you have people downplay it, and Fox News is playing this bizarrely as if Trump is the champion and winning here. But, you know, you convict him and all of a sudden some people are going to start to look at him in a different light. And that's what polls show, although these polls are hard to take seriously in most cases. I think it can matter.
I agree with Norm's assessment there. I mean, that is sort of the clear reality that we find ourselves in. And, you know, I have railed against what I perceived as a judiciary that seems loath to actually engage with Trump the way they would engage with any of us talking right now. You know, it is just everyday citizens. And I stress that for me, that big dividing line is former. He is a former president. He is not the current. It's a whole different thing if you're talking about a current president. But a former president is nothing more than a U.S. citizen, like everybody else. And so I think that, you know, a lot between what the judiciary has done and what the press has done, quite honestly, in leveling up these matters of Trump's behavior has really been a disservice in some sense to the way people are ultimately looking at these cases, these trials. And that's one of the things that really concerns me is at the end of the day, what Trump's people and himself and what his people have been doing is largely laying the predicate for saying that this was all a witch trial and doesn't mean anything. And therefore, when a decision is rendered, could invoke some level of violence or negative response publicly. And that's unfortunate because we're getting duped in believing something or behaving in a way that is antithetical to the system, but that we know when we step back and look at it, we wouldn't behave that way. We didn't behave that way in this trial of the century known as OJ, right? There weren't people out storming and, you know, they were glued to their TV sets waiting for the verdict. But when the verdict came, there were no riots. And that was a big trial. And so we can behave like normal folks if we're not provoked to behave otherwise.
I think one of the dangers is that the press is focusing on this shiny object along with encampments at universities. But I looked up, what's the enrollment of UCLA? It's like 45,000 people and several hundred are demonstrating. Well, they have a right. Meanwhile, the former president in an interview basically lays out a plan for dictatorship and no one's covering it.
No one's covering it.
Pretty interesting. And so most people in America don't know that he has overtly planned a dictatorship for the United States. And if you say it, they go, oh my goodness, that couldn't be true. But one thing I learned in the January 6th committee is you really have to listen to what Trump says because he does mean it. And if he's convicted, I think most Americans know he's a sleazebag. Most Americans know that he abuses women. That's not new. I think for the people who haven't made up their minds, which is not that large a group, a conviction may be of some importance. But I think as we move forward, the publicity on the dictatorship might actually be more important. We're at the very beginning. There's no campaigning going on yet, really, on what the two choices are. And I know, you know, young people saying, well, I'll never vote for him because of Gaza. Well, okay. Are you saying you're for internment camps for immigrants? Because that's the other choice.
It is remarkable because, you know, there's a built-in drama to a trial. But as you say, this announcement, you know, in plain black and white, you compare other sort of autocratic leaders who were sort of stealth candidates and made their changes after they got in. I just want to add one point. If no one's paying attention, it doesn't matter. But there are two aspects that are potentially diminishing for Trump here. And one is, as you say, especially with the very, very narrow cadre of potential swing voters, the misconduct itself, the dishonesty. And maybe I overemphasize this from having been there, but there's a sense in which the trial diminishes him and actually erodes what is sort of a signature attribute that his followers care a lot about, the sense he can do whatever he wants. He's having to sit there pretty meekly, often dozing off. There's a sense that, you know, Trump is just not the big shot that his supporters, I think, very much cleave to. Let's move to the gag order. So, you know, they're at the precipice now in a way no other judge has been. Merchan has basically told him next step is jail. What do you think? Is this a guy who, for political reasons, wants to actually be put in jail for a few hours or more? What's your sense of his motivation here?
I'd say, please make everybody's day. Put his behind in jail. That's where I stand. I think you use the system the way the system is meant to be used. And if you violate the rules, this is the price. And Judge Merchan has made it very clear, albeit for my taste a little late, but nonetheless, at that precipice of saying your next move, sir, is to spend a few hours in prison or at least in a jail cell. Does Trump want that to happen? Absolutely. It's right on brand for him. It is like, look, poor me. I'm in handcuffs. Look how well I wear them, you know? Absolutely, he wants that. And his sycophantic followers absolutely thrive for that moment. Why? Because it lends credence, justification for every bad form of behavior they want to put in place. I mean, they can't act out now because they look, oh, a little bit extreme, even though we know that they are at their core. They are containing themselves, if you will. But that action, sure. But that, for me, quite honestly, Harry, just tells us we need to, as institutionalists, those of us who believe in the rule of law, those who believe in the authority of the United States Congress, those who believe in the institutions of the judicial system and the criminal justice system and all of that, we have to stand firm in that moment and remind the American people of why this punishment is imposed. Not because he's Donald Trump, not because he's some poor, put-on, persecuted soul, but because he's a criminal defendant, for heaven's sakes.
And anyone else would be there. By the way, thus say we all, you guys think that this is his political plan? Because we're now at a point that if he insists, he's going.
I think he does want to be. I think he wants that. I think he is tempting the judge so that the judge doesn't have a choice. I mean, to some extent, the prosecutors, I don't think they're going to ask for incarceration. And if they don't, the judge will not impose it. Any other defendant would have been in jail long ago. But I think this may be something that Trump thinks helps him. I think it probably does with his base. The impact, that will break through. I mean, if the candidate is in jail, I think most Americans will learn that fact even while they're going to work and taking overseeing their kids' homework. And I don't know that that will be helpful with that cohort. I don't know, Norm, if you disagree, but
I'm going to play devil's advocate here just a little bit. I think theoretically Trump wants this. In real terms, he's scared shitless of going to jail. This is a man who is not just used to his creature comforts, but spends hours each day being bronzed, having his hair fixed. You put him in a cell in an orange jumpsuit without the people who can put the bronzer on him. He will look like a haggard old man. And when he comes out of that jail, there will be cameras there. And the image that he has so carefully cultivated will disappear. Also, he's not going to have his girdle. He is going to be sticking out in a way that, you know, we see sometimes when he bend overs on the golf course and we see this humongous rear end. But he has tried to look in a different way. And then the question becomes, can he help himself? Can he keep himself from actually saying the stuff that puts this over the top, where Judge Merchan has no choice?
Norm is giving me a whole new way of looking at that question.
Maybe not for too long.
Well, not for too long. No, the bending over on the golf course part, I'm trying to get out of my mind.
Right.
But he's absolutely right. And I think that is the bravado of Trump beating his chest and praying to God that they don't actually take him up on his bravado.
It reminds me of Jim Traficant. He had this phenomenal hair. You know, he claimed his wife did every day. Well, when he was in prison, we found out it was a wig and he was bald and it sort of crushed his persona.
Yeah, I mean, look, I will also take a slightly dissenting view from what you said, Congresswoman, in that I do think the DA will now, if we continue to braze in violations of the gag order, it'll say it's time for an incarceratory penalty. And your point is very well taken, Norm, because maybe with Secret Service or whatever, you know, 2 hours, he comes out only a little unkempt. But then what? Does he then behave? Because once you're talking about an overnight stay, he is just a mess. Maybe they haven't thought it through. But I just want to summarize your position, because I think the basic point that we all agree is if he really wants it, they're now at a point where the judge will give it to him. But your argument would be he doesn't want it. He wants to keep posturing, but maybe he'll get it anyway because of his sort of form of Tourette's or whatever. He won't be able to stop himself from really violating the order. Is that the Ornstein view?
Yeah. And if you look at him after the $9,000 penalty, by the accounts of everybody who was there, he looked penitent. And as I've been looking at the Truth Social post up to now, he's going after the judge, hammer and tong, because for whatever reason, Judge Marchand did not include himself in the gag, but he has not gone after the witnesses or the jurors since all of this.
And I'll tell you something else. His lawyer was really nervous. He had been really beat up by Marchand before, and trying to sort of justify Trump's conduct in the whole gag order process is tying them in knots. Okay, so that, along with Opix and Michael Cohen, are dramas to follow. Let's move on. There's so much more to talk about, and I think our next episode will probably get back to the nitty-gritty. But arguably, as the Congresswoman's already mentioned, the biggest story of the week, mayhem on campuses all over the country. You know, this may be a slightly indirect point of entry, but I do think there's almost a kind of civic religion around the 1960s protests over the war, and that kind of animates the current encampment occupants, I think, want to or derive some sense of inspiration from that. So let's just start there. We've all thought about them, studied, maybe lived through them. Do they seem analogous, this current wave, or do they seem disanalogous with the 60s protests?
They seem less widespread. There are certainly people who have very strong views. But when you take a look at the broad demonstrations that occurred in the 60s, I mean, you would have hundreds of thousands of people showing up at the Capitol. This is a relatively small group of demonstrators. As I mentioned before, you've got, you know, 45,000 enrollees at UCLA and several hundred demonstrators. The same is true of all these others. And I remember I was working on the staff of Don Edwards in the early 70s. Some of the demonstrations that were there, I mean, like close to 1 million people. That's not what this is.
So I want to tell a little anecdote. In 1965, I entered as a sophomore at the University of Minnesota. I was living at home. And I went for registration. I wanted to find something else to do. So they had all these stands up, and there was something called the Students for a Democratic Society. And I thought, well, I'm a student. I'm for a democratic society. So I signed a little form, and then I went to a meeting. 10 minutes into the meeting, I said, oh, my God, I'm getting out of here.
The FBI already knew, however, but yeah.
Yeah. It was a different time in some ways. But let's remember, there were hundreds of thousands of people, in part because there were hundreds of thousands or millions of us facing a draft and facing the prospect of going to Vietnam. And while it certainly touched a nerve and there was a moral core surrounding what we were doing in Vietnam, it's different. And this is different. it may be, you know, the analogy in Colombia, Mark Rudd and some of those people who were genuine radicals and literal bomb throwers in some cases occupied a building, and it's the same building now. But I'm with Zoe. This is a relatively small group of people.
And again, many of them are not from the university. They seem to be older professional protesters.
There are certainly some of those, and it wouldn't surprise me that some of them are coming from the RNC, which is no longer Michael's RNC.
No.
And they're coming from a lot of different places. But it's being treated as a story that's much larger. And yet it's also a story that involves universities and what they are and what they're all about and who's running them. And that is a big story.
It's a little odd. On the one hand, you have administrations espousing the same sorts of principles. Yes, free speech. No, for any kind of interruption of the educational function. Definitely no for harassment, etc. And yet you have a really dramatic divergence of how universities are reacting to this. On the last few days, Brown is saying, we'll look at divestment, and others are capitulating to demands. And, you know, Chicago, Columbia, UCLA are saying, man, enough is enough, and we warned you. It feels like universities themselves, maybe this has something to do with the legacy of the 60s, are deeply conflicted, confused, don't know what the hell they're doing, sort of. Is that fair? And what, you know, what's your sense?
Yeah, no, I think that's very fair. And I think that's an accurate assessment of what we've seen play out. These universities find themselves in a position that they have over the last 10 years placed themselves in, where they picked and chose what type of voices would be allowed on their campuses. So for all the free speech rhetoric that you're hearing now, that was not necessarily the case when they were kicking certain conservative voices off campus, or they were being shut down by students. And now you have a more progressive voice that is not only much more animated, but in many instances, violent in their response. Yes, you know, outside infiltrators notwithstanding, the universities find themselves in this awkward position of shutting down that speech and now having a vehement reaction to it by a student body that they, you know, turned a blind eye to when they were picking and choosing the kinds of speeches on their campus. So the reality of it is, if you're going to open up this Pandora's box, be prepared to play with all the stuff that's inside of it. If you don't want to open up this Pandora's box, then make it very clear through administration policy from day one that this is a place where we believe in the free exercise of speech. But like, you are not allowed to yell fire in a theater. Here are the limitations on that. And this is what we will safeguard against. So you don't have these moments arise where students decide that they're now going to be screaming pro-Palestinian BS rhetoric and having that sanctioned. No, we don't.
Although a lot of colleges have said exactly that, maybe all of them, but then they've dithered or backed away or, you know, set deadlines and not done it. My son goes to University of Chicago, and I'm, you know, he feels really proud that this is the university that just didn't play in this park, as you say, so they can do the line stronger. But I think boards of trustees and administrations are tied in knots and look like the inmates are running the asylum, you could say. You know, I want to quote you, Michael. Maybe this is unfair, but it seems like they're saying in Hamilton Hall, we want to be revolutionaries and take over the building. Now, would you please bring us some food?
Right.
That unfortunate press conference.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, Harry, we can't end this conversation without talking about the lawyers. Because, you know, as I watched those three university presidents excoriated by Elise Stefanik, a woman who, of course, said nothing when Trump had dinner with the Nazi Nick Fuentes and with Kanye West, the anti-Semite, railing about anti-Semitism. And all three of these presidents had been coached by lawyers and were dumb enough not to understand the politics of the situation. So they all repeated this script of it all depends on the context. And my guess is a lot of these university presidents now are reacting based on what their lawyers are telling them. instead of doing what they ought to be doing to try and create the right balance.
Yeah, applying the clear principle. I do think that's right. That's maybe a legacy of the 60s as well. And where it really plays out is they are very concerned about bringing any municipal cops on campus. But obviously the nice guy campus security force is just not up to doing this, especially if they don't have the administration behind them. Let me follow up on the point you just made, Norm, because here's a very important difference, it seems to me, in the 60s, where not only were there a million, but they were really united. And here we have groups of students pitted against each other, some Jewish students, claiming harassment and intimidation. Is there an element of anti-Semitism to the protests, and are universities sort of not responding well to that? Or just in general, does the feature of warring student groups, how does that complicate the issue in a way that protests of yore haven't really had?
I will say, one, yes, there is a strong element of anti-Semitism. It's certainly not there for all of them, but there are a significant number. I think you have a lot of students mouthing slogans where they don't have any idea what they're saying. They don't know what the sea is. They don't know what the river is. They don't know what an intifada is. But there's rank anti-Semitism as well. But I also think that, there's going to be a long residue of this. I feel for a lot of these kids who miss their high school graduations and now may have to miss their college graduations. And it's a big deal. It's a really important milestone. I think we're going to see a lot of relationships that are messed up. I know, having talked to some Jewish students, that their relationships with many on the progressives are shattered now. A lot of their friends, these friendships are going to be destroyed. The schisms that we're seeing here are really unfortunate ones. And for a lot of campuses, I'm not sure how long it will take them to get back to even some sense of normalcy, including with the divisions, not just in the student body, but with the faculty.
I think all of that is happening on some campuses, but I'm also aware of some campuses in my district where the concern of, for example, Jewish students of not feeling safe have resulted in a dialogue and much greater understanding and sympathy among students. So you're right. We're covering the police response in some cases. If there's violence or destruction, there's a need for that. School's about to get out. If there's no violence, you could just wait people out, honestly, and that would probably be a better response. But it's not all the downside that is on the TV. I happen to know that in some cases it's actually fomented more understanding and more affection among students.
Again, we have this kind of theme of how the media covers and whether it's accurate. So it's hard to know what it's really like in the middle of things.
I think it's a mistake to downplay the deep concern that people have, and not necessarily everybody demonstrating, about what's happened in Gaza. Netanyahu government's response to a horrendous attack has been, as President Biden said, over the top. Tens of thousands of civilians who were in the way and got slaughtered. And these young people, I think, are concerned about that. I agree with Norm. They may not all be alert to the nuances of the rhetoric and the like, but there is broad concern in the country about the Netanyahu response, and it's shared in the Congress on the Democratic side. I'm for Israel. I think Israel has a right to exist. I defend that, and not everybody who's demonstrating does. But that doesn't mean that we're comfortable with how the war has been waged under the leadership of Netanyahu.
Fair enough. So let's use that as an exit and segue question. Trump has come out pretty strongly praising the police crackdown. Biden seems to be treading lightly, in part because part of his natural constituency is already kind of giving him hell about the U.S. role in the Gaza war. To the extent we play this in terms of the national election, who is this favoring? Who is this disfavoring?
Too early to say. It's May. We'll see what happens in the Middle East between now and October, November, but I think this will be very much in the rearview mirror by the time the election is held.
And is this, Congresswoman, the Gaza war or the campus protests?
Both, depending on what happens in the Middle East. I do think for Arab Americans, people with family in Gaza, obviously this will not be forgotten. I mean, it's very personal. But for people who are concerned, I think it's pretty obvious that Biden is now more publicly pressing Netanyahu, and I expect that to accelerate. Clearly, he's not satisfied or comfortable with what Netanyahu is doing. Netanyahu doesn't care as long as the war is going on. He continues to be prime minister. So I do think that will be a dividing point in the near future. And I do think hopefully there'll be peace. What's going on now, we desperately need a ceasefire. We desperately need peace. And hopefully we will get that and begin rebuilding Gaza and displacing Hamas. I mean, when you take a look at the money they spent on the tunnels that they could have spent helping the people of Gaza, it's really tragic.
There was another story today that the first aid shipment going in through this new outlet through Jordan was seized by Hamas. And we know we've had stories that they're taking the food coming in and trying to resell it at exorbitant prices to their own people. There's another part of this story that, following on what Zoe said, we know that there's a very intense effort going on with the Biden administration and Saudi Arabia, and we're almost at a point of having a historic agreement, a security agreement that will include a part that Israel will be made a part of it and really have a broad alliance with other Arab countries if we see a ceasefire, a withdrawal, and then at least some sign of an agreement of movement towards a two-state solution. That will put intense pressure on Netanyahu if he's still there. And I think you'll see a whole lot of Israelis who will add to that pressure. As of today, this is hurting Biden. There's no question. It's hurting him in Michigan, which matters. It's hurting him with a lot of young progressive voters. It's maddening. My friend Wajahat Ali has said, look, he's firmly on the side of Gazans who are being devastated, but you can't vote for Donald Trump, who will make matters so much worse for everybody who's now opposed to what Biden is doing in the Middle East. And at some point, you hope people will come to their senses, but it does depend on what happens over the next few months.
I think the politics of this sucks for Biden. And it sucks largely because of two things. One, I think an incredible inability of his political operations from the political people inside the White House themselves, as well as those outside, more importantly, outside the White House in terms of his campaign, creating the narrative of what this administration has done to avoid, very much to Norm's point, a worse situation with Donald Trump. Which then leads to number two, the media. The fact that you have Donald Trump, I don't give a damn if he is sitting in the courtroom. He walks out of that courtroom and every question to him should not be about that silly behind trial that he's sitting in. But you want to be president, what's your solution for Gaza? Because his position is the exact same as Netanyahu. And all those folks who think for some crazy reason that Donald Trump is the solution, he's going to bring peace to the Middle East or bring peace in this situation, are delusional. And the fact that no one is begging that question with him and putting him officially on the record, since he is now the putative nominee of the Republican Party for the presidency, and getting his take on that, to me, is a dishonorable service to the American people by the press, because they're allowing him to put out this one-line craziness, and he's wrapping himself with the police in the face of these protests to impute that he would be doing something different that would be stronger and more forceful is just utter BS. So the press needs to wake up, in my view, put those microphones in front of Donald Trump's face and ask him, sir, if I recall, your position is the same as Netanyahu, that crushing Hamas is the end game here. So what would you do differently from what President Joe Biden is doing right now?
to the extent he has a position coming out of the box, as I recall, was if I'd been president, October 7th wouldn't have happened, huh?
Exactly.
Boy, there's a very strong theme in this episode of criticism of the Fourth Estate, I think. All really great points. Let's talk a little bit more about the political landscape more broadly. So we've got an interesting situation with Marjorie Taylor Greene and Mike Johnson. You know, to date, the different sacrificial lambs who were speaker have kind of hopped too. And it's been over a month since she has said she's going to try to take him out. And he's basically tacked left, whether for survival or just because he really believed, say, with Ukraine, it was essential. Norman, Michael, you both said you respect Johnson for putting his power on the line for the country. You know, where do things stand in terms of his likelihood of survival and his now making some kind of common cause with the Democrats in the House, who say, in fact, they will push back if Marjorie Taylor Greene brings this to a vote, as she has suggested she would next week. Thoughts about that overall dynamic?
Overall, the bottom line is she's got three votes. That's it. Everything I'm hearing inside the caucus, from inside the caucus, is that there is no energy for this. There is none, zero. They don't want the vote. In fact, I bet this whole thing dies on a procedural motion to table it.
It will die on a procedural vote. Here, I think Johnson is getting more credit than he deserves. His hand was pressed because he was going to get a discharge petition if he didn't bring it to the floor. And there are people in the Democratic side who feel that even though he shouldn't be speaker, he shouldn't be taken out for Ukraine, that is the wrong message to the country. But it's a one-off because this is the guy who helped design the fake electors scheme. This is the guy who lied to the Republicans, telling them that the crazy amicus brief from Texas had nothing to do with throwing out the votes. This is a guy who is an insurrectionist and should not be speaker. So even if he is not taken out now, he should be taken out later.
Well, that'll happen at the ballot box this fall when the Democrats take control of the House. But I think between now and then, the reality of it is the reality that he had to deal with, that, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene had put his speakership on the line. He cut whatever deal he needed to cut with Hakeem to get the Democrats to be able to stomach a tenth of what it takes for him to survive. I think Zoe is right about the political narrative around the speaker's involvement with leading up to and post January 6th. But politically, that has nothing to do with this current situation. And so the reality is the one that both the minority leader, Hakeem Jeffrey, and the majority leader, Mike Johnson, realized is they had to make the move on Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan. They did. There was a political cost to that for Johnson. And the political cost to the House is more chaos, more confusion, if they did not indicate that Democrats would stand with Johnson. Just as Republicans wanted to cry that Democrats took out McCarthy by not voting for McCarthy, they find themselves in an interesting box right now where Democrats will vote to keep Johnson. So what do they say then? And that's the little juicy part that I know Hakeem and crew are very excited for that conversation to ensue.
Well, and the other thing is, how does a speaker continue when he doesn't have a majority of his own?
Exactly.
Yeah. I came to Congress in Washington in 1969. I worked with Don Edwards when I was working for Don Fraser, and so may remember that. That is 55 years. I've never seen a more embarrassing Congress than this one. You look at the output. Okay, we got this aid months late and with an awful lot of Ukrainians who died as a consequence of the delays. The idea that Mike Johnson had a revelation on the road to Damascus and now is going to be a bipartisan is ridiculous in the extreme. But there's something to flag here and just to keep an eye on. This is not the last challenge. There's going to be nothing of substance coming out of the House by and large. Remember that the spending deal ends October 1, September 30th. There's going to be a lot of pressure from Republicans in the House, Freedom Caucus, and others to bring a government shutdown then. They want a government shutdown so that they can create chaos because they think chaos will hurt Joe Biden. They may be right about that. They also, and I'm sure Trump will push them on this too, don't want the federal government out there overseeing an election a month later. Will Mike Johnson stand up against that? There will be, I think, a broad bipartisan agreement that no, we shouldn't be doing this. We need to have another continuing resolution. Let the next Congress, the next president deal with all these spending issues. And I am skeptical that he will have the strength to do what he's done now, what he did with the original spending deal, which is what got Kevin McCarthy bounced. And he got away with it by doing this under suspension and relying on Democratic votes. He basically pulled the same thing with this aid package. Will he do it a third time? I don't know, but I certainly don't hold out any hope that this is a speaker who has been redeemed or has changed as a consequence of this one act.
It's now time to take a moment for our sidebar feature, which explains some of the issues and topics that are prominent in the news. Today's sidebar is about how federal law has attempted to define and regulate so-called obscene material since the 19th century. To explain this topic, we welcome Rinna Groff. Rinna Groff is a playwright and performer. Her plays include Fire in Dreamland, 77%, Comfort Inn, Compulsion, and The Ruby Sunrise, among others. She is a founding member of the theater company Elevator Repair Service, and she wrote for season 2 of Showtime's Weeds. She is also a recipient of a Whiting Writers Award, a Guggenheim Fellowship, an Obie Award grant, a Rita and Burton Goldberg Playwriting Award, and 2 NYSCA Individual Artist Grants. I give you Rinna Groff on federal obscenity law.
Federal law has attempted to define and regulate so-called obscene material since the 19th century, but the effort has bedeviled the courts and generated intense social controversy. Obscenity laws in the United States originated in the 1800s. A major anti-obscenity activist of the period was Anthony Comstock, head of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. The 1873 law that bears his name made it a federal crime to mail anything which was, quote, obscene, lewd, lascivious, indecent, filthy, or vile. Anything designed for, quote, immoral use. And specifically in one section, any items, quote, adapted or intended for producing abortion. That later section was recently invoked by Justices Thomas and Alito in an oral argument in abortion case. Famously, however, the law did not provide a definition of obscenity. It has fallen to courts to try to define the term and to carve it out from First Amendment protections. In general today, the private possession of obscene material is not a crime, but the production and distribution can be. In addition, governments can regulate the time, place, and manner in which obscene material is sold or displayed. In the 1960s, the Supreme Court famously struggled with trying to distinguish sexually explicit material lacking in artistic value with subjective ad hoc judgments, summarized in the words of Justice Potter Stewart, quote, I know it when I see it. Then in 1973, the Supreme Court's decision in Miller v. California set out guidelines for juries to use to determine whether material was obscene. The Miller test, which remains the law today, focuses on whether a work's depiction of sexual conduct offends contemporary community standards and whether it lacks serious literary or artistic value. The Miller test implies that as communities become more tolerant of sexually explicit material, fewer works fall under the rubric of obscenity. A national collision between the First Amendment and federal obscenity laws occurred in the late 1980s. Over a traveling exhibit of the photographs of Robert Mapplethorpe, which included graphic depictions of BDSM conduct. The Corcoran Gallery in Washington, D.C. canceled its plans to show the exhibit under intense pressure from conservative groups and politicians. The following year, a Cincinnati museum was indicted under Ohio obscenity laws for showing the exhibit, but was acquitted at trial. A landmark ruling of the internet age occurred in the 1997 Supreme Court case of Reno v. American Civil Liberties Union, in which the court unanimously struck down provisions of the Communications Decency Act, aimed at protecting minors by criminalizing so-called indecency on the internet. The decision is taken as establishing that online speech enjoys similar protection as books and magazines, rather than the more limited protection afforded to television and radio. For Talking Feds, I'm Rinna Groff.
Thank you, Rinna Groff. Rinna will have her West End debut as a musical book writer this summer with the London premiere of a new musical, Your Lie, in April, based on the best-selling manga by Naoshi Arakawa.
All right, it is now time for a spirited debate brought to you by our sponsor, Total Wine & More. Each episode, you'll be hearing an expert talk about the pros and cons of a particular issue in the world of wine, spirit, and beverages.
Thank you, Harry. In today's spirited debate, we dig up the dirt on the agave plant to find out the difference between tequila and mezcal. So first things first, tequila is a type of mezcal, much like bourbon is a type of whiskey. In general, tequilas are mezcals, but not all mezcals are tequilas. Allow me to explain. Tequila can only come from the blue agave plant in specific regions of Mexico, like the region of Jalisco, where the city of Tequila is located. No coincidence there. Mezcal, however, can be made from many varieties of agave, specifically from the heart of the agave, known as the piña. The distillery process for tequila and mezcal is also different. Tequila is produced by steaming the blue agave and then distilling it in copper stills for a toasty, clean taste. On the other hand, mezcal, which appropriately means oven-cooked agave, is cooked in earthen pits with wood and charcoal before being distilled in clay pots. No wonder mezcal, which is typically consumed straight, has more of a smoky, earthy taste. Of course, the best way to get to know the differences between tequila and mezcal is to pick up a bottle of each from your Total Wine & More and pour hundreds of years of tradition right into your glass. Cheers!
Thanks to our friends at Total Wine & More for today's A Spirited Debate.
All right, let's finish up with a word or two about the president. He's got a sort of more, it seems, or is it just a temporary kind of offbeat or sort of zippy kind of approach? His quip at the correspondence dinner, of course, age is an issue. I'm a grown man running against a six-year-old. He sits down for an hour-long interview with Howard Stern. Is there some kind of conscious effort to make him, you know, a little more young and humorous and the like? Or what's going on within the White House, you know, strategy now for Biden?
I don't know what's going on in the White House, but I'll tell you, if you sit down with him, if you're with him personally, he's funny, he's smart, he's on top of things, he's tough-minded, but people don't know that. And so I think these interviews actually show the guy who really is there and who's a pretty funny, attractive, and nice guy. He's a gaffe machine, but he's always been a gaffe machine. That's nothing.
I met him in 1973. Right after he'd come to the Senate. I was a young academic writing a book on the Senate. I tried to interview senators, and he agreed to give me 15 minutes. An hour and a half later, he said, come back tomorrow. But he, you know, the stuttering has made that gaffe issue a bigger deal. Another problem that he's had is he's had back issues and he broke his foot. So his gait is stiff. He bends forward. He looks older. When you're with him, you don't see that. I agree certainly with so. I think the White House and the campaign is now realizing that the biggest weapon they have is the presidential bully pulpit. They have not used it effectively enough. They're going to use it more effectively now. And I thought the most interesting moment at the White House correspondence dinner was when Peter Baker of the New York Times won an award, went up there and had a little conversation with Joe Biden after we have seen this all-out war that the New York Times is waging against him because he won't give them a separate interview. And I would love to know what the two said to each other.
Yeah, Norm, that was a clap because they held each other's hands for an extended period of time there.
Right.
So it was very interesting to watch that unfold. I agree with both Zoe and Norm on this one. Look, the president, I've always said from day one, you know, I remember being on Morning Joe at the beginning of the 2020 presidential cycle and saying when every Democrat was talking about everybody other than Joe Biden, that Joe Biden would be the nominee of the Democratic Party, and then going on in the summer of 2020, indicating that Joe Biden would be the next president of the United States. And I'm here to tell you today that Joe Biden will be reelected in November. And the reason why that is when Joe Biden is allowed to be Joe Biden, everyone appreciates Uncle Joe. They appreciate the neighborhood fella at the end of the bar who has wit and wisdom and says some crazy ass stuff. They appreciate the guy who, you know, helps a kid when he falls off his bike as he's walking through the neighborhood. That's the Joe that we are seeing more and more of. I think to both of my friends' point, the fact that his political operation are just now figuring that out says a lot about, you know, the slowness of the operation, but the realization they're not going to win this election without Joe Biden. President Biden is one thing. Joe Biden is someone else. And that's the person who's going to stand on the stage, whether Donald Trump is there or not, and defeat him in a debate, for example. So I, you know, there's a lot of gnashing of teeth and worriness, and there should be because of how we started our conversation in this moment. But I think in the end, the American people realize they are better off with Uncle Joe than the threat that comes from Donald Trump.
All right. And there's an end, which I'm really sorry about, because being able to tap your three collective wisdom is such a privilege. And I think for our listeners as well. We got 1 minute left for our final feature, five words or fewer, where we take a question each of us has to answer in five words or fewer today. Christy Noem now says she shot the dog to protect her children. How does she discipline her children? Five words or fewer, please, guess.
Hopefully not that way.
Okay.
Threatening with Kim Jong-un.
Professor Steele.
I got nothing. It's stupid.
Okay. And I'm going with suspend their truth social privileges. We're out of time. Thank you so much, Representative Lofgren, Michael, and Norm. And thank you very much, listeners, for tuning in to Talking Feds. If you like what you've heard, please tell a friend to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever they get their podcasts. And please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. You can also subscribe to us on YouTube, where we are posting full episodes, talking books, and bonus video content. You can follow us on Twitter at Talking Feds Pod, and you can look to see our latest offerings on Patreon. Talking Feds is still a completely independent production, so if you like the work we do and are inclined to support the show, joining our Patreon is the best way to do it. You can now leave voicemails with your questions for me and our guests, whether for Talking Five or general questions about the inner workings of the legal system for our sidebar segments. All you have to do is call 727-279-5339 and leave a voice message. And you can still also email us your questions at questions@talkingfeds.com. Thanks for tuning in, and don't worry. As long as you need answers, the feds will keep talking. Talking Feds is produced by Catherine Devine, associate producer Meredith McCabe, sound engineering by Matt McCardle. Our research producer is Zeke Reed. Rosie Dawn Griffin and David Lieberman are our contributing writers, and production assistants by Akshaj Turbailu. Thanks very much to Rinna Groff for explaining federal obscenity law. Our music is, as ever, by the amazing Philip Glass. Talking Feds is a production of Delito LLC. I'm Harry Littman. Talk to you later.